And we're prepared to hear argument on the last case, which is Modern Font Applications versus Peak Restaurant Partners and Dine Brands Global, 2020-22-78. Mr. Clegg again.
The court will pause momentarily to set up the next video.
All right, we're running too fast. Mr. Bonilla, can you hear us?
Yes, I can hear you, Your Honor.
We're ready. Mr. Clegg, please proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Barry Clegg, and I, as previously mentioned, represent Modern Font Application, the plaintiff in this case. During this hearing, as I mentioned, for simplicity, I may refer to appellant as MFA. And I will try to keep the issues specific to this case because of the multiple appeals today by MFA. On appeal, there are multiple issues involving multiple defendants, so there's a lot of issues to address, and I'd like to focus just on a couple of primary issues because of the time constraints.
Let me just focus you right off the bat with respect to Dine. Dine doesn't seem to have had activity in Utah. So there's no venue with respect to Dine. Is that not correct?
No, Your Honor. There were some. Some evidence of Dine sending employees and representatives to Utah. Dine also. One of the primary issues is Dine said in their declaration that they had property in Utah, that they inspect restaurants in Utah. Dine has employees that act for them.
But do they have a regular and established place of business? They're not incorporated in Utah.
Yes, they do have we believe they have a regularly established place of business in Utah. And they're not incorporated there, but that's an issue of residency versus established place of business.
But your whole theory about venue depends on finding that Dine is responsible for the activities of its subsidiary, Peak, right?
That's the primary issue, is whether the subsidiary's actions or properties and such would be imputed to Dine. But they did declare that they had property in Utah in the declaration that they submitted to the court at the outset.
But Dine itself doesn't have a regular and established place of business on its own. The only way it could have a regular and established place of business is if you're right that the subsidiary activities are attributed to the parent, correct?
I don't know that I would agree with that, but I do think it probably would be more helpful to address specifically some of the procedural issues that go towards, I think, the issue that Your Honor is concerned with regarding whether the actions of the subsidiaries and the assets of the subsidiaries, the established places of business of subsidiaries, can be imputed to Dine. And, regarding that, the motion to dismiss that was granted as to Dine was improper for a proper venue, ignored procedural requirements of the Tenth Circuit. So in the Tenth Circuit, under Hancock v. AT&T, the Tenth Circuit permits three options for court faced with a venue challenge. One is denying the motion to dismiss. The other is holding an evidentiary hearing or drawing all reasonable inferences in MFA's favor. Drawing all reasonable inferences in MFA's favor and resolving all factual disputes in MFA's favor. And the court didn't do any of these. Instead, it made inferences against MFA and resolved factual disputes against MFA. Dine's briefing asked the court to compound the error by arguing factual disputes against MFA. But Dine never contested in his briefing MFA's argument that district court failed to follow the allowable procedures. On that alone, the court should reverse the district court under Hancock v. AT&T. Going back to Pete for a moment, and Al Bashashi, would you like me to take these in the order of the defendants or those issues, or would you like me to stick with dying for now?
Why don't you deal with Peak?
Okay, so addressing the dismissal of Peak, MFA pled all the elements of both direct and induced infringement as the key. At the outset, I think it's important to remember three principles, legal principles. One is the plaintiff's not required to plead infringement on an element-by-element basis. And two, 10th Circuit held in Inter v. Prime Equipment Company that the purpose of Rule 15A is to provide litigants, quote, the maximum opportunity for each claim to be decided on its merits rather than on the procedural niceties. And three, the district court is required to draw all reasonable inferences in favor of plaintiff. And said, you know, Bill of Lading, the court said, quote, nothing in Twombly or its progeny allows a court to choose among competing inferences as long as there are sufficient facts alleged to render the non-movement's asserted inferences plausible. So in this case, Pete filed an initial complaint, or an initial motion to dismiss, I apologize. And in that motion, the complaint was that MFA had used the term defendants in the plural, and so they couldn't tell when the complaint was alleging acts against Pete versus acts against Dine. The court dismissed on that basis and said as much in its later order. So MFA filed an amended complaint, and the Peak opposed that, and in response, the court granted motion for leave to amend the complaint, said that MFA had fixed the problems, and had, and in fact, the court actually said that MFA had specifically alleged, made allegations regarding inducement.
Mr. Clegg, you're appealing the court's denial of your motion for sanctions. You had a motion for sanctions in the other case, which was
right.
Also appealing, and of course it seems that it was your responsiveness that the trial judge had trouble with in the prior case, but you're appealing sanctions in both cases. The judges are different, the defendant and counsel are different. Do you ask for sanctions in all of your cases?
No, Your Honor. In fact,
may I add that I heard a case that you argued against Alaska Airlines back in December, and in that case, you also argued for sanctioning the opposing counsel.
Yeah, at the district court level, that is the case, in that particular case. I just want to make sure I'm keeping track of my time, Your Honor. I guess I'm still good.
Do you do this as a matter of course in all your cases?
No. It's true in these particular circumstances here in the District of Utah that that has happened. So in each of the instances, a little bit different. In the Alaska case, that was related to discovery issues. And in that case, they had actually violated court orders regarding discovery, and we requested sanctions because of that.
So what's sanctionable here?
Okay, so in this case, the issue has to do is a rule under Rule 27. This is addressing the issue regarding a 30B6 witness, and the 30B6 witness effectively, for all effective purposes, really didn't appear for the 36 deposition because the witness was unprepared. Numerous questions were asked regarding topics that were approved by the court, and the witness said that he had not read documents, that he said, well, to know that, you have to go ask such and such person at some department. He acknowledged he did not talk to anybody, had not reviewed documents on topics that were specifically approved by the court. So we were stuck asking questions where the witness comes in and said, I don't know, I wouldn't know that. And it was one example would be lease terms. One of the topics was leases in Utah, and the witness had acknowledged he hadn't actually reviewed the terms of the lease, even though that was one of the topics of the 36th deposition. And then we weren't, MFA wasn't permitted any document discovery or any written discovery.
You got a second 30B6 deposition, right?
We did, but that was expensive and cost a lot to go down there, and it was limited on topics, and there was still no other discovery provided, so it made it difficult to test the positions that they were taking, and so they made a few sort of generalized responses to questions, but when it got into the nitty-gritty questions, they didn't know answers regarding underlying facts to support their kind of conclusory statements during the deposition. And the second 36 wasn't sanctioned. It was because discovery was deficiencies. And so that was really about, it was limited to a specific topic.
You are into your rebuttal, but you can continue if you wish.
I would like to reserve the remaining for rebuttal.
We'll save it for you. Mr. Bonilla?
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court?
Morning.
My name is Ricardo Bonilla. I am representing the defendants, appellees in this matter, Dine Global Brands and Peak Restaurant Partners. And I want to address a couple of things that we just heard from opposing counsel before getting into the more substantive aspects of this appeal. Specifically with respect to the issues about sanctions for the 36th witness. I do want to note this was not the first motion for sanctions filed by Modern Font in this case. In fact, when we first appeared on the case and asked for a 30-day extension of time to our response deadline, when we filed a motion to dismiss, Modern Font thought it appropriate to move for sanctions because of that conduct. There have been quite a few requests for sanctions, none of which we think were meritorious. And with respect in particular to this 30B6 issue, one of the things I heard from opposing counsel just now was that the witness didn't review the terms of the lease agreements. The problem, of course, is that lease, those terms, those were lease agreements that to which Dine Brands is not a party. It's Dine's subsidiaries that may be involved with those agreements. And in particular, when it comes to these leases, there are actually four entities between the franchisees that sublease the properties and the eventual ownership up to Dine Brands. And so one of the problems that Modern Font was faced with, and one of the reasons why it was proper for the lower court to grant the motion to dismiss for improper venue with respect to Dine, is that the named defendant is Dine Brands Global, and that entity doesn't have any regular or established place of business, regular and established place of business in Utah. It owns an entity that owns entities that own entities that then sublease property in Utah. But they are not one and the same, and they shouldn't be treated as one and the same in this case. Another thing that we've heard quite a bit from opposing counsel is that Modern Font, that the court did not accept or make all inferences in Modern Font's favor. But the issue, of course, is that it's not just whether Modern Font can speculate as to what set of facts would be most beneficial to it. It must have some kind of evidence. And faced with the evidence that was presented by Dine, with two 30B6 depositions, totaling 8 hours, faced with that evidence, Modern Font would have had to present some kind of evidence to suggest that the facts as laid out by Dine were untrue. And that's simply not the case. Dine does not have a regular and established place of business in Utah. Its subsidiary, it has subsidiaries that that may have some property interest in Utah, but those aren't Dine. And this court has been clear that when it comes to the regular and established place of business analysis, the identified location must be of the defendant. And here, there are no locations that are of Dine. Now, we've heard quite a bit from opposing counsel that there are reasons why those actions of the subsidiary should be imputed to Dine. But that's a high burden to basically ignore the corporate form when you have entities here that did anything but. They maintained corporate separateness. They maintained separate accounts, separate statements. Something we see in the briefing from Modern Font is that because Dine had a consolidated financial statement, meaning that the financials were various entities on a single consolidated statement, that meant that they were combining all of those funds and that they are using all the same accounts and they're using all the same employees, and that's, again, simply not the case. Simply just because a party consolidates its statements does not mean it is not respecting the corporate form. And in fact, there can be quite a bit of overlap between entities, but the courts will still respect that corporate form. And that's what should happen here. And once that's the case, once that's established that these are separate entities, there can be no question that Dine is not properly venued as a defendant in the state of Utah.
Why don't you move on to Peak?
Absolutely, Your Honor. With respect to Peak, there are two kinds of issues, the direct infringement and the indirect infringement. Now, for the direct infringement, Modern Font alleged that Peak's employees would download the mobile application, the IHOP application. But there aren't actually any plausible allegations those employees were doing that. Modern Font did say that if it were given an opportunity to amend its complaint once again, it could provide more detail, and that it would have more facts it could allege that would establish this issue of direct infringement. But of course, if that was the case, Modern Font should have included those facts in any of the three opportunities it had to make its allegations in its complaint. It initially filed its complaint saying defendants, plural, were acting in one way or another, but without making clear which defendant was performing which act. So the first motion to dismiss was filed by by Peak to say that it could not tell what actions it was being accused of conducting such that there was infringement. And the court agreed and said, yeah, there are issues here that, if not remedied, would render Modern Font's allegations implausible and therefore would be properly the subject of a motion to dismiss. Modern Font then amended his complaint in response to that, but kept more references to Dine, even though Dine was dismissed for lack of proper venue. And we opposed their motion to leave on that basis. And the court noted that there were still factual issues, although opposing counsel is correct that the court said that they had fixed, Modern Font had fixed the first problem, which was referring to the defendants together in every instance. It did not fix the rest of the problems, which is that there are no allegations, nor would there be, that Peak employees were downloading this app in the scope of their employment. To the extent they were doing anything like that, they would be referring to their own personal devices, doing it on their own personal time, actions that should not be attributed to Peak.
What about the customers? Inducement of customer infringement.
And that's exactly what I was going to go next, Your Honor. That's the indirect infringement issue and induced infringement. And you'd ask in the other case about if when customers download these apps, is that enough for infringement? Certainly that's what Modern Font alleges. But there's then the problem of intent. There has to be specific intent on behalf of the named defendant, here Peak Restaurant Partners LLC, to cause or induce its customers to infringe, not just to download the app, not just to take action that could then later be alleged to be infringing, but to actually infringe. And there are no allegations that Peak had notice of these patents, and specifically noticed that the website or the menus that say download the IHOP app were inducing customers to infringe the claims in these patents. And then that also brings up another issue, which is that the menus are controlled by the IHOP brand subsidiaries, not by Peak. All Peak does is sublease or lease the properties where they have these restaurants and act as a franchisor. So there aren't allegations here sufficient to plausibly show that Peak intended for its customers to infringe. They have menus that say download our app, but that's insufficient. There has to be specific intent of inducing an infringing act, and we don't have that here. And again, we heard from opposing counsel about how there could be, you know, they'd ask for leave to amend. They asked for leave to amend in opposing all of our motions, and each time they said, we could add more facts. And the judge here, Judge Stewart, looked at that and said, okay, you told us you could add more facts. You've had multiple opportunities to do it. You haven't done it. And so if you fail to cure deficiencies, which is what happened here, then it is, the court is within its discretion to grant the motion and to do so with prejudice. Now, there are other issues that opposing counsel that Modern Font put into its briefing. In addition to the sanctions issue, there's this issue about Rule 12, D2. I think all of those issues are well briefed and will rest on the papers there unless there are questions from the court. But the main issue that Modern Font has here is that it sued two entities, one that was improperly venued and the other that doesn't have enough to do with what they are accusing of infringement to be a properly named defendant in this case. And therefore, the allegations asserted against Peak should have been dismissed with prejudice, and this court should affirm that decision. And the allegations against Dine should have been dismissed without prejudice before improper venue, and that decision should also be affirmed. To the extent the court has any other questions, I'm happy to answer them, but otherwise we'll rest on the papers for the remainder of our arguments.
Thank you, Mr. Medea. Mr. Clegg has a few minutes for rebuttal.
I apologize, I was muted. How much time do I have, Your Honor? I want to address quickly that the issue of sanctions, MFA's had 18 sanctions, there was only, and MFA's only requested sanctions in three of those. Regarding this case, they mentioned earlier that we requested sanctions over delays. There was no request for sanctions there. There was a suggestion that it would be sanctionable, but it was never requested. And then regarding opportunities to amend, there were not three opportunities to amend. The court dismissed the initial complaint over this issue of defendants. It's more like a Rule 12E and regarding clarifying which party was which. The court said that it was, MFA filed the request for leave, and the court said that granted that leave and said that all the issues were fixed. Then, next, on that first amended complaint, there was another motion. So there was really only two motions to dismiss, and the issues on which the complaint was dismissed with prejudice only came up in the second motion. They were not in the first motion. It's the first time, so there was really no opportunity whatsoever to amend on these issues. The court acknowledged that, and as Mr. Bonilla acknowledged as well, that MFA proffered facts that could have been amended into the complaint to fix the perceived deficiencies. Mr. Bonilla makes a lot of arguments regarding, you know, IHOP's conduct with its employees, or Peak's conduct with its employees, but those are all, you know, this is not summary judgment. Those are pleading issues, and inferences should go in favor of MFA. And, you know, there shouldn't be sort of arguments on what facts should be accepted and which facts should not be. Regarding the issue of control and the menus, the menus, you know, irrespective of whether Dine or its subsidiaries control what goes on the menu, Peak controls the menus going to customers. It controls its employees. It controls handing those menus to and having its employees hand those menus to customers. And it's indisputable that the menus include instructions to download the app and that downloading the app is an infringement because it combines the software with an apparatus or a handheld device that is then infringing. All the other allegations regarding inducement are there. Knowledge of the patent, knowledge of and intent can be inferred basically based on the knowledge and knowing the allegations. The fact issues raised by Mr. Bonilla and Dine and going towards sort of the intermingling of the corporations, there's numerous facts showing that there was not separateness between the corporations. And just a couple of examples regarding that issue is that one, the district court found that the management was intertwined as well as the financing arrangements. Some of the issues, though, is if you look at the bank accounts, all of the bank accounts are controlled by Dine. It's all their employees, so their employees, their management, they control them, they're the signatories. No money ever changes hands. Dine tries to use this word account and uses semantics to suggest that they have separate accounts. And there really aren't separate accounts because what they have is essentially itemizations. But when their witness testified that in response to making these itemizations in a spreadsheet, no money ever changes hands. No money is moved out of any bank accounts. It's all controlled by Dine. Dine controls the day-to-day activities of the subsidiaries. Dine and subsidiaries do not charge each other for services because there's no change in money. Dine uses subsidiary assets to pay debts. There's multiple other aspects. They share offices. Dine pays the rent. Dine pays the payroll. Dine pays the HR, the training, computers, IT, everything. And no money ever changes hands.
Mr. Clegg, the hands of the clock do move, though. Your time has expired, and so we will take the case under submission.
Thank you, Your Honor.